Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Dennis Cooper. This is part of a series that I'm calling A Heartbreaking Group of Staggering Geniuses after the book by David Eggers, because it seemed to me suddenly and at last that there was an emerging group of writers, some of them in consciousness for quite some time, but a group of writers were being created who deal with the innards of fiction writing and the vicissitudes of their generation and are looking for forms to match in the novel the problems that are going on in their heads and in the world. And I think, in a way, one of the elder statesmen, but certainly primal figures in this group is Dennis Cooper, whose new novel, Period, has just been published by Grove Press. It's the fifth book, the completing book of a series that began with his novel Closer, followed by Frisk, Try, Guide, and now Period. You know, Dennis and I first met when I moved to Los Angeles around 19 years ago, so we've been talking, really, for some 19 years. And as a friend, as well as admirer, it's a kind of extraordinary thing to reach the end of this series, which has been celebrated by a symposium at NYU. There were articles in the New York Times and the Voice, Village Voice magazine in New York. To begin with, what does it feel like to end such a long-standing project?
Some weird combination of, like, relief and terror, because, I mean, in some ways I think I started writing specifically to write this work, and yet at the same time I feel so finished with it. So there's a sense of, like, feeling pretty satisfied or feeling like it's complete and there's nothing left to do, so kind of restful feeling, but at the same time it's like I'm uncertain about whether my gifts will apply themselves to other subjects, which is what I'm trying to do right now. So it's a mixed thing.
Now, for the first time, I think you attended this conference at which academics, musicians, artists, and others spoke about this group of novels. What do they talk about when they talk about you?
Well, the academics, strangely, they were strangely aligned for all their idiosyncratic takes on it. Well, you know, it was what's been a really great pleasure to me about finishing this series and the way it's being received is that was sort of occasioned there. The academics really spoke a lot about the issues that interest me, which are about, you know, inarticulateness and language and the culpability of authorship and relationship to the unspeakable and all sorts of things. They spoke about them formally a lot, and I always think about my work in terms of form and language and things, because the subject matter is so ingrained in me that it's almost not of interest to me. It's so intuitive and so propulsive for me. So I think about them in terms of form, and so it was very, very interesting to see the work discussed that way and not in terms of, like, you know, the outrageousness or the horrific nature of the subject matter. It was treated like literature, and I guess it was really, like I said, gratifying, because I don't know, I'm not sure that, I think my work has been sort of misunderstood because of the subject matter before. So it was great. I mean, in terms of the other people, the rock stars and, you know, artists and stuff, I mean, that was just amusing and like an honor, because some of the people that read my work, you know, like Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth and Steve Malkmus of Pavement and Robert Gober and John Waters, I mean, these are people I admire tremendously, and Bret Easton Ellis and Lynn Tillman, and I just, you know, that was just sort of like a big thrill, you know.
Now, do you have any idea? I've always wondered why it is that the experimental tradition, so-called, if one can call experiments a tradition, which seems crazy to begin with, but why it is that it links itself often with taboo or proscribed or horrific subject matter?
Well, my guess is, I mean, based on my experience and as a, I suppose, a long-term avid reader of work like that, is that in work that's really good or really strong in that realm that you're talking about, I think that the writer understands that it's that there's no way to get to the bottom of the material, so there's a kind of presenting of confusion or something. And I think that maybe that's the reason why the forms are so complicated, is because the normal ways in which one writes a novel, I mean, you know, conventional narratives or things like that, or that, you know, there's just no way that's ever going to get to the bottom of the material, because, I mean, for instance, in my case, my relationship to that material is so complicated, and I've been writing about it for most of my life, and I still can't get to the bottom of it, you know? I don't know.
I've also wondered whether it might not be something to do with parenting, you know, in that old way that to have a book is to have a child.
Hmm.
In a certain way, to have a normal child makes for, to some extent, a normal parent. But then there's the science of teratology, the creation of monsters.
Hmm.
And these books seem, whether we're talking about John Barth's The Giles Goat Boy, they seem to be about deformity and the birth of both an unusually shaped book containing unusually shaped monsters. And your books swarm, in a certain sense, not only with odd shapes, but with children with, if not physical, mental deformities, and if not from birth, from their experience in the world, by the end of the books, they will be in some way mutilated or deformed. So I wondered about parenting.
Mm. That's an interesting point. you mean like sprung full-bodied from the head of Zeus kind of parenting?
Well, the sprung full-bodied from the head of Zeus, but not as Diana, but as a monster, a gorgon, an ogre, a Medusa.
Yeah, I can see that's true. Of course, you know, to me, I feel great tenderness towards them, I don't know. I think that, of course, they're very deformed, and the books are, and of course, my interest in it is deformed. Perhaps it's just a matter of I'm so purely involved in the books that I can't even imagine that one couldn't love these things I make or something. I mean, I don't mean that in an arrogant way. I just mean, to me, they're really, really sympathetic and tender, and I guess I don't even think of them as being physically deformed in a funny way. I mean, maybe I think of them as being sort of, evolved. I don't know.
Very good. Well, you've spoken along this line in an interview, and you said, to my mind, fascinatingly, that each subsequent book, bears the mark of the devastation that occurred in the previous book, and therefore operates within a more narrow or limited setting. Could you explain that a bit? How does that work?
Well, as briefly as possible. What this work's always been about for me is about two things. One is a friendship I had with a very complicated boy when I was young, named George Miles, and whose effect on me was just overwhelming and profound, and in fact affected my entire life, the kinds of relationships I had, the way he looked affected the way people interest me and stuff. So I wanted to sort of get to the bottom of that relationship with him. That was one thing I was doing, and the other thing was just was trying to understand why I have such a strange, intense, schizophrenic interest in acts of violence and brutality that are driven by sexual obsession. And so it was a matter of combining the two and following them through. So I came up with this, with Closer was the first book, and I had this idea that there would be a kind of a series, and they would somehow get to the bottom of the of this. And George was, they worked well together because George was probably the most sympathetic person I ever knew, or the people that I find most sympathy with always remind me of him. So to put him in the midst of all this was a way for me to keep, you know, the love there, because through all the other brutality that goes on. Anyway, so I wrote Closer, and which I think of as being sort of the uber novel of the series or something. I mean, everything that was going to be in the rest of the books had to be in Closer. So, and that would be the material I would work with afterwards. So, and Closer is very concise. It's very tight. It's very I don't know. I feel like it's very sealed shut, vacuum-like. It's like a skin, has a skin. And then I just slowly dismantled this body. But using specifically for me, whatever violence happened in the narrative of the novel would dictate the amount of damage physically in the novel following in the form. So Frisk is a very damaged book, and it reveals the kind of complicated structure, and also reveals the fantasy. Each book has a kind of concentration. So Frisk is like an exploration of the fantasy around that material. Then Try, it reflects the damage in Frisk, and that book is concentrates on emotion. For me, it's like about, so emotion takes priority in that book. It's about love. I mean, it's about the love between these two boys, but not a sexual love, because one's straight and one's gay, and it's about love. Then, again, followed the same with Guide, and that was about the mind. It was my mind. It was basically an exploration of my mind in relationship with the material. And the idea is that there's stuff being stripped away every single time, and so there's less and less and less. By the time you get to Guide, there's just this almost no body left, and there's just this mind kind of overcompensating for the lack of sparsity. The sparsity of the narrative. And then in the last book, Period, there's just nothing left. I mean, there's a zombie. There's a skeleton. And so there are all these tricks and things to make it work, like a lot of strange sort of silly magic tricks and goth things and Satanism and psychics and all that stuff to make it work. And that structured it. And through the book, the one material is being explored, and the other one was to get to the bottom of the George thing. And so as the books proceed, even though George is not named in every book, all the young men mm-hmm. in them look exactly like him, are exactly the same type. And that reflects my life, because my life has been full of people who reminded me of either like the way they were or the way they looked. My interest in people has been driven by that. So there's these replicants and replicants and replicants. And then by Period, it's just nothing but replicants and mirror images and stuff. And George, who the real George who killed himself, is very, very far deep into all this stuff. And the book like makes all the book, Period's an attempt to make all the replicants and all the stuff built around George disappear in this, so that all that's left by the end is just me, a writer, and George, this person that I loved and don't understand why.
In Period, and by the way, I'm talking to Dennis Cooper, this is Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. In Period, the creator figure, a man named Walker, is accused on a website, in email, in a chat room, of being someone who addicted George to him, made George dependent on him, and then abandoned him. And the book has its barricades of guilt and accusers. And in many ways, the sadness in this book comes with a kind of bleak fact that no matter how many times these situations are replicated with less and less and less emotion, so that people are just in some way ritually, emptily enacting the death of George.
Yeah.
But guilt becomes a question. Two members of a rock band who travel about performing murders and videotaping them and interviewing each other after they perform these replicated murders. The band is formed in memory of a band that occurred in a novel by the author of... It's very inbred and complicated, but they feel no guilt at all. What about your guilt at the end of the series?
Well, that's a really good question. I do feel really guilty. I mean, he was a very complicated... I mean, I can only speak about it, the real George, really. I mean, because that's... He was a very complicated boy, and I tried to help him and save him. I mean, I have a bit of a caretaker problem, I guess, and I did everything I could, and I couldn't, and he killed himself, and I lost track of him for a while. I lost track of him the entire time I was writing the books, and only found out he died right when I started Period. And even though, I don't think that I could have done anything, really, but I do feel like a kind of guilt and a kind of... I mean, one of the reasons why the book, I think, is about its own failure at the end is because, you know, I mean... What was all that about? I mean, I loved this kid, and he loved me, and we, you know. It was an utter failure. He killed himself, and I don't have my friend anymore, and I didn't do him any good at all. So, that's kind of the true of the books too. You know, I mean, it's like.
But do you think that is almost an essential part, or something like that, of the need to write? I mean, is expiation or some kind of perpetuation?
Sure. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I write about things that I almost never have done, and I wish I had done sometimes, or couldn't do, or... Yeah, sure it is. It's got to be... That's got to be key to all of it. It's just that in this case, I sort of think about it more because of... I think by concentrating on George and on this material, I've been able to sort of really realize with this book what... That wasn't... That's true, that has been at the root of, for me, writing, yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask you about certain key things that inform the series, just so that readers who are entering your world can now enter it from an aerial perspective now that the shape has been completed. It is a series of five books. Why five?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that just happened. I didn't know how many there would be, though I did have a sort of like a sense of the structure that I wanted to make. But I didn't know how, and when I was writing Try, I sort of had the sense that I might be in the middle. So then I thought if I could write Guide the way I wanted to, which was, you know, which I explained, there'd be one more. I don't know. It just happened that way. I like the odd number of it. I mean, there's a mirror thing going on, and the five seems to make sense in terms of all the books have the same structure, and I don't know why, but the number five, it's so perfectly balanced, you know, five things, and so there's like the one in the middle, and it, you know.
Well, I found that the first book balances the last,
sure.
And that those are the two books that are most centrally concerned with George.
Yeah. Well, and Guide and Frisk, which are the both, which have a fictional Dennis in the middle of them as well.
Right,
yeah.
And so it's very much arranged around a kind of circle.
Yeah.
And a symmetrical figure going on. Mm-hmm. There are seven chapters in period, and each of them, I'll read the names of the chapters. Chapter, Circled, Caveman, Crippler, Cycle, Converse, and Curtains. Begin with the letter C.
Yeah.
I wondered why.
I don't know. That was a purely intuitive decision. I think it does mean something, but I have no idea what it means.
Yeah, I wrote in the margin of my
book, figure it out?
Seven C's, but then I couldn't go any further.
Seven C's. That's exactly what it's about. You got it.
But it does, the books do seem to be need to be controlled by certain structural devices that may or may not be relevant. That impulse, you were describing it earlier as a vacuum or something sealed off with the skin, that impulse to create a hermetic and interiorized world, what is it about?
Well, it just, you know, it just in a dumb way, it reflects, it's just, I try to make an accurate reflection of the way I think about things or what it's like to live in my head. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. That's really what it's about. You know, and reflect the complicated ways I think about it, but also give them this sort of artificial and inappropriate structure. You know, just like to house them, to keep them in control, and to make them accessible. I mean, I'm always very aware of. I mean, I rewrite my writing so much, and it's when I write it, so make sure everything is like really easy, as easy and clear as possible. So, I don't know. I mean, but it's a combination of like building a structure that's self-contained but has a lot of space in it. It's almost like sculpture. I mean, there is a lot of like ways to look between the space, between the structures. I mean, the structures are rather open, you know. There's a lot of things that aren't described, so I feel like that is kind of breathing area or a kind of way to look in. And then I just ground them in pop culture a lot as a way to show that even though like my head is like very very strange and remote place, that my interests are like in pop culture like everybody else.
Now, as you started out, I remember hearing, as you'd give readings, people laughing at sections of the book in that old way that I had suspected, you know, a kind of, isn't this funny, mass murder, a hip way.
Mm.
And the books have been, it seems to me, both about rejecting and coming to grips with that accusation of hipness. Can you talk about that?
I think one of the things that hopefully is interesting about the series is that it does start at that place, and yet it goes so completely far away from it. I mean, I do use black humor in the work. I mean, I am, like I said, I'm very aware of how people think about this material or where they want to think about it. So I do still use that, but now I use it in a more subversive way to kind of you know, counteract itself and get at something that that humor could have nothing to do with.
In the course of writing the book, three French bees have had enormous effects on the shaping of the book. Robert Bresson first, I think you found Bataille and Branchot afterwards, and I wondered if you could talk about what you learned from those three mentors.
You know, Bataille isn't as big an influence on me as you'd think. You know, it's more Sade, you know. I think, actually, the really formative ones were, they're all also French, were Bresson and Sade and Rimbaud. Those are actually the three, and the intersect, somehow where that work, the three work intersects, is really key to wherever I am. But, I mean, of course I admire Bataille, and I'm sure I learned from his work, and Blanchot, I definitely did. Bresson, well, I mean, it was really important to me that to write in writing about this material that there wasn't an ego in the writing. That was really, really important. I wanted the writing to be transparent, as complex as it was. And then Bresson taught me that. I mean, his work is almost all style in a funny way, but it's an egoless and transparent style. It's a style that's entirely in service of emotion, the characters. And so it's on the one hand extremely apparent and extremely controlling, calculated style. It asks nothing for itself. It asks only things for its characters. You know, that it's very clean. And well, Sade I read, you know, way too young at 15, and I read the 120 Days of Sodom, and it was just a couple of things. One, that you know, this was serious literature, and it had a serious philosophical thought in it, as idiosyncratic as that philosophy. I mean, it was a very rigorous book and a very beautiful book. And at 15, I just went, whoa, you know, I mean, this can be literature. I mean, that was the first thing I ever saw that made me think I could put my own, write about this stuff. So that was important, really. His own style, although the structure of 100 Ways of Sodom was actually very important to me, because it is a very complicated book. And Rimbaud, just the idea that that writing could transcend writing, you know, its own fundaments and be about something else. I mean, Rimbaud's poetry is an attempt to do some kind of an alchemical experiment with language, where the language becomes a vehicle for some kind of like sublime idea, and he fed through this incredible youthful punky attitude and stuff. And I mean, that was just a key influence. I still want the language to be about more than language. I mean, I want it to be incredibly language or languagey. About language, but I want it to be about something completely different. And so, I mean, those, in that way, those three were the ones for me.
I remember that before Closer came out, we had found Rumblefish by S.E. Hinton, which was, as much as one can imagine, a young adult art novel, weirdly. Yeah. And if anything, Closer was an adult art novel about young adults, but it remains a very seductive way for young people to find your books. In fact, I think still, although how many years ago was it that Closer?
89.
10 years ago. I think if kids read it, they're going to find people they know in the book.
Yeah.
And more than that, they're going to find a level of pain and excitement and confusion that they don't find in other books that is identifiably the life of an American kid. You know?
Well, a lot of kids read my work and write me and tell me, you know, kind of my readings and stuff, and they often Closer was the one that was so important to them. Yeah.
And then they come into these books almost as into a maze. Mm-hmm. And I think it was John Hawkes who once said, my material is shaped not through consciousness and plan, but I send the material ruthlessly down a corridor of psychic whippers. but the experience of your work after that first book is definitely going to be one of interiority, bruising, formal and psychological mutilations. Yeah. And I wondered, as I once asked the man who translated all of Sade into English, how you feel about the effects of these books on the generation who read them almost for news of themselves.
Well, I don't know. I can only judge by the reactions I've gotten. And what's really, I mean, it's really strange because some of these kids that read the books, you know, I mean, I think of myself as a really literary writer in a funny way. And to hear Avital Ronell or someone speak about my work, I mean, I go, yes, 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 you know. But in a sunny way, these kids like really understand it better than anybody do. Mm-hmm. Because in some ways, I guess I'm just like this weird, I'm so adolescent in a funny way. I mean, I'm 47 years old and I'm still like such a kid. And and they seem to understand in the right way. I mean, they don't think that, you know, they don't want to run out and get killed, or they don't, you know, they don't see that. They see that it's about, you know, how difficult it is to feel and to have people, you know, to have people feel things for you, to feel things for other people, and that's really what it's about, and that's what it's always been about, really. And I don't know. I'm like, I think it's wonderful that they're into it, and they don't seem particularly, you know, sick kids. They seem like fairly, you know, like me. They remind me of me when I was a kid. You know, they read a lot of books and they go see, you know, the right bands and blah blah blah. So I don't know. It's nice, you know.
A final question. Do you feel that there is an emerging new fiction coming to the fore, or is it the creation of a media? And if so, who are the figures that interest you?
No, I actually do, and I wouldn't have said that a few years ago. I
mean, yes, it's very new, it seems to me.
This actually is just this year that I started to sort of notice it, and I think actually this Dave Eggers phenomenon is what kind of brought it into focus. Maybe, I'm sure, for a lot of people. I mean, David Wallace, I mean, he's my favorite contemporary writer, and I've always been a huge fan of his. But yes, I mean, you start adding, it seems like everything's consolidating, and there's like him and David Antrim and Jonathan Lethem and Eggers and this guy Dan Alewski, and, you know, and, I mean, there's so many. You can go on and on and on. And it's a kind of, I mean, it's insulting to them to say it's metafiction because it's something entirely new, but, you know, Rick Moody, I mean, you can go on and on. I'm not sure all of it's great. I don't know, but I'm incredibly excited about literature for the first time in many, many years, you know, that, and then the kids are reading Dave Eggers and David Wallace, you know, I mean, over, you know, Nick Hornsby and Alex Garland. I mean, I know, I'm not saying those are bad books, but I mean, kids are actually reading this really complicated stuff. I think it's a renaissance, and I mean, God knows if it'll add up to anything, but I personally find it thrilling, and I, you know, as a reader and a lover of books and as someone who looks for comrades, you know, I feel some comradeship with these people.
I've been speaking to Dennis Cooper. His new book, Period, has been published by Grove Press. Thank you for joining me, Dennis.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.